Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
In the belly of the bear, an FBI journey behind the new Iron Curtain. The collapse of the Soviet Union was a historic turning point when many, especially those who grew up during the Cold War, began to let go of their long-held fears and embrace feelings of hope for the future. This included agents of the FBI who were busy building bridges with their former adversaries. It is the subject of a fascinating new book called In the Belly of the Bear, An FBI Journey Behind the New Iron Curtain. It's by Jeffrey Iverson, who joins us today live from the US. Good afternoon from us. Good morning to you, Jeffrey.
Good afternoon to you, Giles. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure's all mine. If you can just explain a little bit about the background to this book and how you came to write it.
Well, the background is basically, now I have been an FBI agent. I was an FBI agent from 1984 to 2007, but I think more importantly, I was someone who grew up during the Cold War and who was very, very affected by the what was happening at the time, and very preoccupied in my childhood with the Soviet Union. You know, like all of us, certainly in the U.S. and I'm sure in other places in the world, you know, I grew up hiding under my desk, you know, during drills that we had at school, and reading about the bomb and watching all these TV shows about the bomb. And it was a pretty frightening time for all of us, I think. And so later on, much later on in my life, as I grew up and went into the FBI, I had the very distinct pleasure of being assigned to work Russian organized crime back in the mid-90s, when this was becoming a whole new notion to us in the FBI, in Russian organized crime. That was a whole new concept that no one had ever even really thought of till that point in the mid-1990s. So that's really, that's basically the background. From there, there were a lot of opportunities I had to work with the Russians, to work with the Russian National Police at the time, the MVD, and to travel to Moscow, and then later on in my career to actually live and work in the former Soviet Union in Central Asia. And after that, a couple years in living and working in Moscow, working with the whole new world, a whole new brand of law enforcement officers with the former KGB.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because if you just that period of time, if you take the 10 years from 1984 to 1994, excuse me. In 1984, none of us could see what was happening. The Berlin Wall was still up. We were still really with the idea of MAD, nuclear assured destruction. The Soviet Union was the empire. You know, Reagan had said the Soviet empire, the Soviet Union was part of it was an evil empire. Star Wars, etc.
That's right.
And yet here, and then 10 years later, Russia is thrown over, you know, the Soviet Union no longer exists. And people are moving into Russia with the sort of belief that it's a great new free market. They're going to be able to make some money out of it, but not thinking about what's coming the other way.
That's exactly right. And it was just, and not just as an FBI agent, but as someone who grew up during the Cold War, a Westerner and an American, this was just an incredibly new, exciting at the time, very, very exciting time. I mean, it was for me, and I think for so many of us, it was time to just take a, you know, let the air out, just take a deep breath and go, I just cannot believe this is happening. And it was wonderful. But things definitely changed not long after that. So I was very privileged, I think, you know, that I saw it during a great time. I got to travel and work in Russia during a wonderful time when it was very friendly and cooperative and productive. And then I got to work there at a time when things were starting to slide back to the old ways.
And of course, there's a, because people maybe don't remember or don't realize it, but there is a substantial sort of Russian community in the U.S. and also Ukrainian communities, Georgia, etc., from all of the what used to be the Soviet Union and now are their independent countries and whatever. And yes, there are great flows of culture and of business, but there are also, you know, it also brings that sort of particularly interesting strain of criminality. It must have been two things must have been interesting. One, to work against these people who are interesting characters, to put it mildly, and B, to actually interact with people who we thought were our sworn enemies up until 30 years ago or 40 years ago now.
You are exactly right. And, you know, the kind of crimes that we were dealing with in the early days were, I mean, they were new to us. This was really a shrinking world, obviously. And, you know, I don't think any of us in the U.S. and certainly not in the FBI were aware of just the explosive power of Russian organized crime in those days. I mean, the new Russia had so much wealth in its own way with oil, gas, aluminum, precious metals, timber, and people were really kind of, you know, Russians and former Soviets were really, really picking those resources clean in a lot of ways. You know, under Yeltsin in those days. And, you know, so they had all this money and all this resources and what to do with it. And places like the United States and places in Europe started to become kind of a place where they could, they could hide their money. They could invest money that they had earned what we would call illegally. And, you know, so this was just an explosion that we were pretty well ill prepared for in the mid 90s.
And of course, the thing is, there was an awful lot of sort of shipping out of wealth, and in a lot of places, people don't really mind where the money comes from. I mean, and as long as the money is relatively clean. I'm speaking to you from a studio in southern Spain. We had an awful lot of Spanish investment, Russian investment into Spanish companies through real estate, whatever. London, of course, well known for some oligarchs setting up shop there as well. So, you know, it was really a case of perhaps some of the West weren't perhaps as stringent as they should have been. And on the flip side, perhaps in those early years, the West was a little bit naive, thinking that, okay, Soviet Union has opened up. We can open a McDonald's there. We can put a Starbucks. That we just thought they were going to immediately embrace democracy as we knew it, not knowing that there's a sort of a history of strongman politics and Russian democracy doesn't work like that.
You are just so right about that. And, you know, I think even the Russians were, you know, a lot of them in those early days were very excited, you know, about the changes. But pretty quickly, I think a lot realized that this was not, at least the way it was being applied in the former Soviet Union, democratic values, capitalism, was not working exactly the way they intended. And there was a lot of poverty. And that's one of the earliest visions I have is just, you know, just how people were struggling the first time I went there in 1998. And there was no middle class really in those days that I could see. It was just one extreme of the other, extreme wealth, or just, you know, people, you know, basically, you know, older people, especially who had been hit by pension problems and hyperinflation, selling older women, selling lilacs and single cigarettes at the metro stations just to get by. And it was a real contrast.
Sorry, I just might turn my own microphone off. That was clever. So what, you know, what were the first, when you went over to work in Moscow then, presumably it must be really interesting as an FBI officer working with, I mean, I'm of a generation that will immediately think back to Belushi and Schwarzenegger and Red Heat, you know, that film, that movie from back in the day. Yeah. But I mean, presumably, yeah, you know, Russian police officers or detectives or whatever, or that level must be quite characters. I mean, there must be some really interesting tale, an awful lot of vodka, I would imagine, being drunk, but also yeah, some really sort of, because it's, It is basically like, I'd imagine, you know, one of those hard-bitten dramas, and then some, as we say in England.
Yeah, those early days, again, were just so... you go into a situation like that, and for me it was in 1998, the first time. You go into a situation like that with these stereotypes that you grew up with during the Cold War, and you know, and the stereotypes, and I really am emphasizing the word stereotypes here, were that, you know, that there was a lot of alcohol, that, you know, people were atheists, that people were kind of grim and gray, and the whole world was, you know, gray. When I went there and started working with Russian MVD police officers, this was a group that, I guess, maybe it was just they had taken the lid off. We'd all taken the lid off of, you know, decades of tensions. And we really let the steam out. And it was really, really a lot of fun. And at the time, very productive, too. And you had to deal with corruption. You know, you had to find your way around to find who you could trust and basically who you couldn't. But once you got into those circles, and once I got and my partners got into working in those circles, these were people who were just very soulful, very fun, rich with humor. The jokes were just, I mean, it was just belly laughs, a lot of belly laughs. And I'm not trying to say that all we did is party, but it was a very work hard, play hard environment in those days. And these were people who, you know, guys mostly in those days, there were not very many women working in law enforcement unless it was a support capacity. But these were guys who just really just, we just let the, you know, we just tore the roof off in the evenings after a hard day's work. What? And it was a real get to know you time. And it was a fun experience.
This is the perhaps the saddest thing about what is happening or has happened over the past couple of years, because, you know, I've had some good nights with the Russians as well, and my goodness, yes, when they let their hair down, they really do. But they are, and I mean, it might sound funny or stupid, but there also can be an incredibly sentimental people at a base level as well, at a same level as well. What were the sort of crimes that you were looking, I mean, these are probably large scale. Is it money laundering? Is it prostitution? Is it people trafficking? And of course, we also begin to see the start of things that will ramp up massively, which is international terrorism, because of what's happening in Chechnya and you know, the Grozny and all that sort of situation. So what were your main, the main sort of cases or the main subjects you were dealing with?
Well, when I was first started working Russian organized crime, I was working in San Francisco. And so we formed a Russian organized crime squad in about 1995. And that had been following kind of the same kind of squads being set up in New York and other big cities where there were a lot of Russian speaking people. And the crimes that we were dealing with, especially in the early days, was I would call it money laundering. I mean, what we had in San Francisco was a Russian company that had been set up in San Francisco. And the company's purpose was to receive hundreds of millions of dollars of rough, uncut diamonds from the Russian that were owned by the Russian government. And they set up a production factory in San Francisco where they cut and polished. And then they were supposed to, you know, send the finished diamonds back to Moscow. Well, the company was actually set up by a group of former Soviets who were living in San Francisco at the time. And basically what they were doing is was wholesale skimming off the top of the diamonds. I mean, you can imagine they just got shiploads, you know, tons of rough diamonds, sold them here in the U.S., and we're living like kings. I mean, very extravagant lifestyles and high-end properties that they were buying in San Francisco. And, of course, you know, it was obvious that there were kickbacks going back to you know, the people in the Russian government who were responsible for overseeing the sale and the transportation of the diamonds. So it was a big scheme, and that one of the biggest, the hardest parts was really identifying Russian MVD officers that you could trust. And that was pretty much facilitated at the time. The FBI started expanding its permanent posts in foreign countries, and Moscow was the office, an FBI office in Moscow was opened in about 1994. So we had permanent FBI agents stationed in Moscow whose job really was to coordinate with the MVD and on mutual, you know, on overlapping transnational criminal cases.
And
so that was one. And so it was called Golden ADA was the company. There were others I can get into if you're interested, but that was the first one that really caught our attention.
So, when do things start to change then a little bit? Is it when Yeltsin goes, when Putin comes in, and it gets the things get to become more authoritarian? And you mentioned there's sort of corruption on a lower level, but presumably it gets to a stage where, you know, if you're not in, why aren't you in? And this is what we expect. And unfortunately, the few good men are being pushed aside one way or the other.
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question too, Giles, because I got to see this over the period of, let's say, from 1998, especially a little bit before that, but personally when I was on the ground in Moscow in 1998, and I got to see it, just this transformation, because I left Moscow in 2007 when I retired. And when Putin came in, so what started happening is the NDD, who are our really principal partners, started getting kind of somewhat pushed out of the, they weren't the king of the mountain anymore in terms of investigations and criminal investigations. And it started to be replaced, when I was there full-time in 2005 to 2007, it started being replaced by the FSB. Now, the FSB, as you probably know, is the former KGB. I mean, the KGB basically broke up into the FSB and the SVR, which is their foreign overseas intelligence agency.
Yeah.
But the FSB, which Putin, of course, was once the head of, was our principal partners. And there was a real contradiction there, because on the one hand, we were trying to work with them daily sometimes on overlapping cases. But at the same time, these were the same guys who had this, you know, this spy recruiting role within Russia, who were looking for weaknesses in the U.S. and the Western intelligence agencies and looking for the spies, you know, much like Robert Hansen, if you remember who he was, the FBI agent who was actually working for the KGB and later the FSB. So it was a very contradictory, I call it strange bedfellows, because it was a very, you know, you had to be on your toes all the time. You couldn't just let go like you did with the MVD. It was a little, I liken it to two cannibals. There was a poem at the time that I learned when I was first learning Russian. It was a poem about two cannibals who live next door as neighbors. And one cannibal invites the other cannibal over to his house for lunch. And, of course, he's very wary of going to his neighbor's home for lunch because he doesn't want to be the meal. And that was kind of the metaphor that I always thought of when I was working in Moscow, when I was working with the FSB, because it was a very, you had to really be on your toes.
And I suppose the other thing is the fact that I'm currently halfway through a podcast on the use of female agents in the West and honey traps, etc., which is fascinating stuff and scary as hell with the FSB about some of the stuff that goes in, and the fact that beautiful young, because Russia exports a lot of things, and beautiful women is one of them as well, and the fact that they were deployed in the States to certain parties who would perhaps like, you know, women who would turn up with guns and shorts on. But one of the things that struck me is the fact that, because in the West we have checks and balances. We like to think we have checks and balances. We like to think that, and also we have relatively finite resources. I mean, I know you're talking with American organizations, but of course in Russia, those sort of kind of rules don't apply, because you've got so much material there in terms of, you know, you've got so much land in which to practice and hone the skills. And if it's all done for the motherland, and here we are celebrating 80 years since the Great Patriotic War, you can politicize and weaponize that particular branch of intelligence and make it a very dark thing indeed.
Absolutely. And that's the thing that really, that's one of the saddest things that I've watched in some cases up close, because I worked very closely with the FSB. But since I've retired, you know, I'm just watching that whole situation slide downhill. It's really painful. And one of the most painful parts is I know from, you know, making friends with Russians and Russian-speaking former Soviets, I know that there are so many people who are just frightened and appalled and heartbroken over watching these changes. And it is a tragedy. And it's been, you know, if you follow this stuff, if you followed it for years, you just watch this very steady but painful decline. And now it's to a point where, I mean, obviously it's a matter of life and death with so many people.
With the invasion of Ukraine, that has obviously polarized and made Russia to certain, it's done two things. I think you agree on Jeffrey on this. It's brought to sharp focus, perhaps. Has it? I mean, you could say it's brought to sharp focus what Russia's up to, but at the same time, Russia has managed to absolutely take aim and take care of the social media narrative on this one, with so much fake news and peddling, and people can't believe what they're seeing anymore, which plays into the hands of somebody who's been trained by the former KGB, etc. You know, and therefore we are in real danger. Well, we are in real danger of sliding back to 1970s Cold War politics and maybe 60s. But at the same time, you've got to ask yourself, what happens? Because nobody can beat death. What happens when Putin goes? And what, you know, where does Russia go from there? And this is probably why you are, why you're looking sort of concerned across from your side of the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very frightening, and you know, this is of course opening up a Pandora's box here to bring up this subject. But in some cases, you know, one of the reasons that I really felt compelled to write the book is because after I retired, in the United States, especially, I mean, over the last, let's say, 10 years, I mean, there are echoes of some of those crazy things that, you know, that I was watching happen in Russia. And, you know, I mean, a perfect example is the conspiracy theories that, you know, that pop up. You know, this is the kind of stuff that I used to see when I was in Russia, that I didn't laugh at it, but it was in a way humorous. If it wasn't so deadly serious, it would have been even more humorous. But, you know, a perfect example is of a conspiracy theory that was going around when I was there was, you know, at the time there were a lot of Americans who were adopting Russian children from orphanages. And you used to see this, I used to see this, we used to see this, especially when we would travel on the Delta flights from Moscow to JFK in New York. And you'd see all these children, little children, babies, you know, toddlers with their American parents, but Russian children. And these were just happy, happy times. Mm. And without going too much into digressing here, but so the theory in Russia among many people was that Americans were adopting Russian children so they could part their organs out, sell their organs for profit. Now, how crazy is it to believe something like that? But this was the kind of thing that was going around, and it was fairly widespread. And you ask yourself, okay, you see this insanity, and then you come to the U.S., you know, and then you read the news. In those days, you didn't think of those kind of things in the West, I don't think. Mm. But in the last 5-10 years and start hearing theories about, you know, the Democratic Party or whoever,
Hello. That'll get the conspiracy theories going. I think we for some reason, I was always going to be a bit worried about that, but the phone system has gone down on me. And we have our guest back due to the wonders of technology. I'm so sorry about that, Jeff. It just went halfway through. We were talking about conspiracy theories and what you're seeing online.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that you got.
We got as far as people saying the Democrats were taking children's. I think we got as far. We talked about children's organs, and then you said other people were saying Democrats, and then it cut out. So I immediately thought that was obviously somebody in the echelons of power somewhere in the Pentagon were cutting me off there.
No, I don't think they're there yet. But you know, that's just who knows.
Who knows?
But so, I'm sorry about the confusion there, but. But my point was that the insanity, the absurdity, the conspiracy theories that I was hearing, while I was in Moscow. And then you come back and you come to the United States and you think, you get kind of smug. That's the kind of thing that happens in Russia. That doesn't happen in the West. And then you start reading about the absurdities, the theories, the conspiracy theories here in the United States. And it's painful. It's truly painful to hear it, to watch it, to see this echo of what I saw was craziness there, here. So,
just one of the things that you've written the book for, if you've written the book about, is to actually, because we are in danger. We are in danger of going back to what we thought from, I remember when I first, because I used to have a house on a lake, yeah, and Russians love their dashes, don't they? They love their drinking in the countryside. Right?
So, and I didn't mind it either, I have to say.
Well, indeed. So I used to have, because I have this beautiful house in Spain overlooking the mountain, and so I used to get these Russians used to come up, and they used to get their fixes used to come up and say to me, would it be okay if we had a barbecue on your land? And I would say, no problem at all. And they would come up, yeah. And I used to always fear the Russians, because it was the Russians. And then they came up, and they were hilarious. I mean, they were different, but they were hilarious, and my goodness, did they have a good time, yeah? And I thought to myself, I grew up in, and I was in London, I was in England, Greenham Common, and the cruise missiles arriving, and Reagan and Thatcher. And I remember thinking as a 16-year-old being really worried about this. I mean, people seemed to, it wasn't all a John Hughes movie, the 80s. It was very serious stuff. And then I thought, and then with the Russians, I thought, these are they're different, but they're fun, and we had a good laugh. And now we are in danger because of everything that certain sections of their government have done, and the reason that, good people are being forced out. We are in danger of, again, pointing the Russians out to be just faceless robots. And that way, madness lies. And that's not the sort of people that you were saying before that you met and who are good people.
I'm so glad you said that, Giles, because that really was actually one of the most fun parts of writing this book, was talking about what I saw, what I felt. They would always try to explain to me what the Russian soul was, and of course this is a very esoteric concept.
Guitar playing at 3 a.m. yes.
Yeah, and it was, but I got such an appreciation. I grew such an appreciation for Russians, for Russian culture, for their history, for what they went through, for why they, why they thought the way they did, why they felt the way they did. And like you say, it was a lot of fun in the process, but it was more than just fun. And so one of the funnest parts, if that's a word, funnest, one of the most fun parts of the book for me was writing about Russians and what I, the awe that I felt in uncovering and learning about what Russians, who they really were, how they felt, what they believed, why they believed that way. And that was fun for me. And it was a powerful, powerful experience, especially if you can imagine an FBI agent growing up in the Cold War and his first steps on Red Square, where we all know, and I know we used to watch, these guys, these old men in gray standing on top of Lenin's mausoleum, watching parades of tanks and missiles and soldiers. And, they were all, of course, out there. They were there. Their enemy was us. The ones that they were there for to protect against or to attack was us. And then the irony of just, stepping foot on that and just seeing all these symbols of Soviet power everywhere. It was just an overpowering, it left a lifelong impression.
The book is called In the Belly of the Bear, an FBI journey behind the new Iron Curtain. It's by Jeff Iverson, who we're speaking to today. Jeff, if people want to find you online, I would imagine as a former FBI, you're not too hot on the social medias, or is there somewhere they can find you online?
That's a very good. You go to Iverson Bear. Bear is in the animal.
Yeah.
One word, iversonbear.com. I can be found on the website there. And but you're right, I'm not really big on social media. You're right. It's never been my favorite, you know, putting my life on display so much. But in this case, I made an exception, which I am, you know, which has been fun.
Well, listen, I'm so glad you could join us today. Thank you for taking the time to speak to us. It's fascinating stuff and a really wonderful period. I think it's going to be one of the major periods of history that people will study, you know, in decades to come. The book is called In the Belly of the Bear: An FBI Journey Behind the New Iron Curtain. It's by Jeffrey Iverson. Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time today.
And yours as well, Giles. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.